Wayne Grudem is, by any definition, perhaps one of the greatest living theologians on the planet. And he's not nearly as famous in the United States as he is in the world. No matter where Wayne and I have gone in the world, students glop onto him. Can I get your signature? Can I get my picture taken with you? And I sit off at the side and I watch all this go. You know, it is just unbelievable what a rock star he is throughout the world. It's because systematic theology has become probably the most important teaching book in the world. And he's got it out there by the millions. And so we don't have to say any more about the comment, perhaps one of the greatest living theologians on the planet. Now, add this. How could you have a theologian like that, and he literally understands economics better than 95% of the economic profession? How could that be? He was not trained as an economist. All Wayne has is a bachelor's degree in economics from Harvard. That's all. I mean, as if that counts for anything. How can he have such a profound understanding of economics? Well, I don't know. I don't know. But I tell you, to get to travel the world with him. So you know what? When the question and answer time comes, we'll talk to an audience of 200 or 300 people, maybe 500. And Wayne always wants me to go first. Here's the question. And Wayne will say, go ahead, Barry. After doing this 50 times, I've said, Wayne, when the question comes, you take it. Because you're like a laser beam. Bam! You hit it. He says, yeah, Barry. But if I answer first, I'll answer the question. You always answer three other questions. And so they get four for the price of one. They get your three and my one. And I say, Wayne, I know, but they didn't ask about the three. They asked about the question that is the question. How does Wayne do that? How does Wayne receive? How does his brain work? The ding, ding, bam. So he insists. He insists I answered first, which is ludicrous. But that's how we do it. It's fun. Oh, my gracious, is it fun. We'll sometimes start a question and answer period after lunch. And sometimes we'll go as long as 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And the people will be saying, stay here, please, one more hour. So we are really, really having fun. Now, as far as his book, Politics, you can get a copy today, get him to sign that for you. I've got to tell you, at the very least, there will be 200,000 or 300,000 pastors that read that book. And for the first time in their lives, a whole bunch of issues will be clarified. They can't teach it because they don't know it. They can't teach it because they've never heard it. They can't teach it because it's never been laid out like Wayne lays it out in this book, Politics. I mean, it is another act of genius and God's sovereignty laying on this man. And so the evangelical church will never be the same again. Now, it takes a while for that book to work its way through. And oh, by the way, not pointing any fingers at any people in this room, but there were some people in this room that made that book possible. So thank you, thank you, thank you. So,
This is not Wayne's plan that the best is yet to come. It's not Wayne's plan, because God knows that all of human history is in God's hands, the sovereign will of God. And Wayne knows, and I know, that we don't think that the United States is necessarily much of a part of end times, if by possibility that we are truly in end times. So the last thing that Wayne would ever think of doing is trying to be a little piece of the sovereignty of God. If the sovereignty of God is that the United States has had its 234 years, and now the end is coming, not tomorrow, not next year, but at the rate of the last 3 years, we don't have to do that too long, and the United States, there's the ball game, friends. And if that's God's will, I'm with it 100%. Because who are any of us to say the United States should play any kind of a role in the future? But Wayne always has the hope that God has more use for this great country, that this country has been the great and light, shining light for the world, that the United States is exceptional in almost every way you cut it, exceptional. What other countries do you know that go out to defend and not to conquer, that go out to protect and not to possess? Name them for me. Would you please name them for me? Does that sound like Japan to you? Does that sound like Russia to you? Does that sound like China to you? Does that sound like Iraq to you? That these countries go out to defend and not to conquer, to protect and not to possess? Does it? Does it? Give me the examples of the great altruistic, wonderful moves of both ancient and contemporary. Please help me, help me. Now, but if we agree that for the most part, that the United States goes out to defend and not to conquer, to protect and not to possess, that we go and give our lifeblood in Europe, literally save the French from their own ears and rears, and save them, and take nothing in return, except they give us a little plot of land there to put our cemetery on. I always get excited about the French. I think about the French. I think, well, I wonder how the French Revolution changed human history. Well, we don't know how it changed history. We haven't had a tough time yet. What would it be like to fight a war without the French, much like going hunting without your accordion? How many French does it take to defend Paris? We don't know. Paris has never been defended. So, okay. So enough on that. But the United States, as far as exceptionalism, are you kidding me? More altruistic food and medical care to the rest of the world than all the nations of the world combined. And you don't call that exceptional? And I could go on and on and on. Mistakes? Of course we made mistakes. Slavery was a huge one. The whole world was making it, including us. And we paid a horrific price. 675,000 men killed in the Civil War. So we paid a horrific price. And to this moment, apparently, we have a people in this administration that says the big problem with America is racism, etc. So it's ongoing. That sin's going to follow us hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. But what can you do except say, I'm sorry, will you forgive me? What if I laid 650,000 boys on the line? Kill them! Kill them! What? Now what? Want another million? Mistakes, of course. Of course, of course. But a very exceptional country. And just maybe a country that still has some significant history in its future. Maybe. If it does, it's going to be because of books that Wayne Grudem wrote on politics. If it does, it is going to bring more enlightenment to more people than you can imagine. And so if God has a future for the United States, and he very well could, I'm so, so very thankful. Because my opinion, Wayne is going to be on all the radio shows, all the TV shows, all the other stuff, and all of a sudden, the world is going to start seeing a different point of view. They don't know because they've not been taught. They don't know because they have not heard. When you have a president of the United States that didn't even live in this country for his first 19 or 20 years, wasn't even in the United States, and then when he does come, he gets a law degree at Harvard. Well, I'm going to share something with you. A law degree at Harvard is almost of no use whatsoever. Law is about justice as the law defines it. And I'm not against the word justice. Of course I'm not against the word justice. But when you come from, you add the word fairness, as the president constantly does. Charlie Gibson says, so, Mr. President, we're now ready to make a transition to taxes. Mr. President, so, even though you would raise the capital gains tax from 15 to 25%, and now you're going to get less tax revenue for the government. By raising that tax, you are going to, it's proven, it, this is Charlie Gibson, a liberal commentator, saying, economists have proved that we will have less revenue for the government by raising that taxes. You're still going to do that. You're still going to raise the capital gains tax. And Obama says, absolutely. Why? Fairness. It's only fair that you take more from the rich. It's only fair that you take more from the makers and give to the takers. It's only fair. That's what he said to Charlie Gibson. That's what he said. Fairness. 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 There we go. There we go. Fairness. That kind of thinking takes your breath away. He doesn't know because he has not heard. If you go to Harvard, take any economics at Harvard, it's Keynesian economics. Let me explain how the world works. From day one to this day, right now, there's been two means. There is the market means and the political means. How do you make economics work? How do you harness the power of incentives? How do you increase prosperity? Basically, two ways to get this done. The market means. What I mean by the market means is the free market, limited government, protected property rights, ownership, letting the market, thousands and millions of people interact, and then just watch the market happen. The market is, gravity is, please, please, don't tell me that the market is an ideology. The market is not an ideology. All the market is a bathroom scale. That is all. That is all. The market is, you step on the scale and it says 175 pounds. That's what it says. That's all the market does. The market is a stupendous transmitter of opinions while determining value. There it is. A stupendous transmitter of opinions, thousands, millions of people, supply and demand determining price, supply and demand determine wages, supply and demand determine profits and losses, determining, bathroom scale, there it is. i.e., the market is, gravity is. The market is, gravity is. The market is, gravity is. Now, what kind of foolishness to come and say, you know what, I've just got a problem with gravity. There's just something fundamentally wrong. And we begin then to try to change this universe. And I'm giving a lecture on gravity and say, it just cannot be, it should not. Wrong! Wrong! You would say the man has lost his mind. You would say, and yet we in our society, the market, an ideology. The market is not an ideology. It's a bathroom scale. It's a transmitter of opinions while determining values. It's a transmitter of opinion while determining values. It's a miraculous instrument of communication. It's one of the most wonderful things, common graces that God has ever given mankind is the market. The market. Okay, you got it. I'm making my point. So, there's the market means and the political means. Now, the political means has two strains to it. Strain number one is, and this is the most virulent part of the political means, is socialism. Let's now say, as Karl Marx said, no, we are going to eliminate private ownership. Now, when Karl Marx says that, notice what happened. The market means says, no, private owner. The market means, and this came from John Locke in 1688, John Locke said that freedom is the mainspring of economic prosperity and that the prerequisite for freedom is private ownership. Private ownership, protected property rights, is what creates freedom, and then freedom is the mainspring of economic prosperity. That's what John Locke said. In other words, John Locke was really serious. Was John Locke more concerned, really, with freedom of religion, freedom of the press, and freedom to own and operate a business? Of course he was. Of course he was. Those are the freedoms that we saw. The freedom to speak, the freedom to assemble, the freedom to own and operate a business, the freedom of religion. So John had the same concerns. He's more concerned with those freedoms. But John Locke made a terribly important point in 1688 in his book that unless you have economic freedoms, you will not have these other freedoms. Unless you have economic freedoms first. So John Locke had it all figured out. The founding fathers were great fans of John Locke, and the United States was instituted on these tremendous ideas of John Locke and rule of law and the Magna Carta and freedom is the mainspring and private ownership capitalism and protected property rights, blah, blah, blah. And so what good fortune we have to have that kind of leadership. But anyway, so the political means is the worst form, socialism, the abolition of private property. Now, right there, when John Locke heard that, he would say, Karl Marx, you are a nutcase, is what he would say. Right there, economists like Ludwig von Mises and Friedrich Hayek, F.A. Hayek, he wrote his book, The Road to Serfdom. If you haven't read that book, you really maybe should. You can Google it up. F.A. Hayek, H-A-Y-E-K, a great Austrian economist, writing the book called The Road to Serfdom. If you take this socialistic road, the abolition of private ownership, you are on the road to serfdom. And you know when he wrote that book? 1944. 1944, F.A. Hayek writes the book, The Road to Serfdom. So that is a way, that's a political means. See, that means is command and control. That means we're going to give government all the power. Oh, not only give, no, we're going to get rid of private ownership and let the government own everything. The public ownership of the means of production. That is the definition of socialism. The public ownership of the means of production. So there's the political means, and here you have socialism. And then in a little less violent form is a brand of economics called Keynesian economics. K-E-Y-N-E-S. John Maynard Keynes wrote his book, The General Theory of Employment, Interest and Money, 1936. John Maynard Keynes wrote his book, 1936. And ever since 1936, Keynesian economics has been the essence of Harvard University. The essence. To this minute, Keynesian economics is the essence of Harvard economics. So now you say, well, what's the difference between socialism and a less violent brand called Keynesian economics? This is simply a brand of economics that says the economy is a machine. The economy has a steering wheel and buttons and things and throttles and brakes. And you need a wise, benevolent government to sit in the seat of this economy, and we fancy it up by calling it monetary and fiscal policy. Bright, bright human beings with monetary and fiscal policy driving this machine. Now, a free market economist just backs off just even from that premise and says, the economy is not a machine. It is not a machine. The market is. Gravity is. It's way more complicated than a machine. It's thousands, millions of human beings interacting in the marketplace, supply and demand, determining price, supply and demand, blah, 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 blah. So it's not, it's an organ. It is. It's like gravity. It just happens. The market just happens. Men and women cannot plan it. They cannot design it. They cannot manage it. That is insanity. Back over here. Almost fell down. Did fall down. Over here. No, no. Monetary and fiscal policy. Wise government. Now, in this wise Keynesian paradigm, there's an interesting fact. The interesting fact is, as long as government is running and taxing and guiding this machine with monetary and fiscal policy, it's impossible in the Keynesian model to have both inflation and high unemployment at the same time. That is impossible. You will either have, running this machine, you'll either have high rates of unemployment and low rates of inflation, or high rates of inflation and low rates of unemployment. But in the Keynesian model, you cannot have stagflation. It is not possible. So I graduate from college with a doctorate degree in 1970, and I now move into the classroom, and for 10 years am teaching both socialism and then Keynesian economics. This is the 1970s. Now, as the 70s is rolling along, we've got a problem here. We've got a problem that we had, first of all, a president in 1970-71, Richard Nixon, who said, by the way, Republican, who said, we're all Keynesians now. Richard Nixon then bought in to the whole Keynesian structure and what it's all about, and Richard Nixon calls himself, we're all Keynesians. And then his idiot vice president who became president, Gerry Ford, also. Gerry Ford is so naive economically that in 1974, 75, and 76, Gerry Ford is having us all... here's what was going on in the economy now. Higher inflation, higher unemployment. Higher inflation, higher... This can't happen in the model. This cannot happen. And I'm in there in the classroom saying, it can't happen. And my students are sitting out there. But it is happening. It is happening. I thought, Dr. Asmus, you said it can't. No, it can't. It cannot happen in the model. And it was happening. So, okay, back. So you have Gerry Ford to fight the inflation, because inflation was getting away from us in the 70s. We're all wearing WIN buttons. Whip inflation now. So we're all wearing these stupid buttons called WIN. I'll never forget. I bring a whole box of those into my students. I have all my students put on this idiotic, stupid, because I was idiotic and stupid, because at that time I was a Keynesian economist. I believed it. You say, Barry, why did you get swept up in socialism and Keynesian economics? First of all, it was the only training in 3 degrees that I had. No one trained me free market. No one told me about the Chicago School of Economics. No one told me about public choice economics. No one told me about supply-side economics. No one told me about F.A. Hayek, The Road to Serfdom. No one told me about Ludwig von Mises, Human Action, and the Austrians, blah, 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 blah. I was trained. That's my first answer. But my second answer is I was a Christian. I was teaching a Sunday school class at the time, and my brain said that this whole socialism stuff makes so much sense from a Christian point of view. How? Fairness? It's so fair.
Yes.
It's so just.
Yes.
I always liked the word public ownership better than private ownership, Byron, sounded to me like kind of selfish. Oh, so Byron is going to own it. So it just sounds, private ownership sounds wrong. Public ownership. Oh, and then community. We're all in this together. We'll all own it. We all own it. There's one problem with that. When everybody owns it, nobody owns it. There's a problem with that. You cannot make it work. Socialists have been trying this for 1,000. They cannot make this model work, that we all own it. Because everybody's business becomes no one's business. There's no personal responsibility. And just as John Locke said, if you really want to manage resources, private ownership, protected property rights, private ownership. But oh, no, no, please, please. That's not fitting with the Keynesian model of monetary fiscal policy. We're going to run this machine. We're going to make it work, blah, blah, blah. So it was terrible. So I just loved the words of socialism. I just loved going and talking to my idiot dad, who all he knew how to do is run a 160-acre farm. That's all. Who couldn't run a 160-acre farm? Well, you could do that in your sleep. Dad, we're talking about running the economy. The world. Dad, get with it. And oh, now, another, when do we have to be done, Ron? In 5 minutes from now? Okay. I haven't even started on taxes yet, but I get next week. I get next week. To start on taxes. I get next week to start here. But another fun, I think this is background. The class next week, they've missed this. and you say, miss what? A fundamental premise on ownership and protected property rights, if you do not have that, then you're not tethered, but then you're really, really not tethered, because the essence of Keynesian economics, and I can absolutely prove this mathematically, as I used to tell my farm dad, Dad, the government spending multiplier is about 1.5. The individual and consumer and individual multiplier is about 1.00. So when you spend, this is going to give the economy a one times hit, 1.0 hit. But if government spends it, it's going to have a 1.5 multiplier. Now, the White House, for the last 2 years, all they've been talking about is that the government multiplier, just as Obama was taught, is 1.5. In other words, if we can kind of lift your money and take your, even though you made it, you deserved it, you earned it. But friends, if somehow I can get it from taxes and I can spend it over a 1.5 multiplier, this baby is going to have a kick on the economy. Your money, just a 1-point kick. Government, now they believe this. I am not lying to you. They believe this. They believe, Obama truly believes, that if he spends $1 trillion, it's going to have a kick on the economy and get us out of this recession. He believes it. I believed it. I only gave it up kicking and screaming. I stand in front of my classes in the late 70s, and all heck is breaking loose, and we're going to stagflation, more inflation, more unemployment, and I'm telling the class, it cannot be. The theory says, listen to the theory. Always trust the theory. You can't trust reality. You can't trust. No, the theory says. And now stagflation is coming over the economy. And you have a Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter. Oh, my gosh. You have inflation. You have high unemployment. You have Russia taking over the world. You have oil going to $70 a barrel in the early 70s. You have a decade that's falling apart. That's falling apart. That is falling apart. And I'm standing there. The emperor has no clothes. Professor, you're as naked as a jaybird. Professor, you really have not a darn thing to tell us. In fact, what are you talking about? I'll tell you what. Fairness, justice, equality, public ownership, government running monetary and fiscal policy. That's what I'm telling you. Professor, it's not working. It's not working. Professor, when are you going to wake up? 2 minutes, Ron. This is a shame to do this, Kevin. To go from the eternal and be fooling around with this dumb subject called economics. So apologies to you, dear friend. 2 minutes. So, on November 6th of 1980, the United States elects a new sheriff. The new sheriff comes to town, Ronald Reagan, and he says, friends, the United States has had 5 bad decades in a row, economically. The 30s, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s. We are now just closing out the 1970s. Look at it. Look at it. January of 1970, the Dow Jones Industrial 700. December 31st, 1979, 10 years later. We're just closing out the 70s. We're just closing out the 70s. December 31st, 1979. The Dow Jones, 701. We moved from 700 to 701. That's a decade. Woo! Boy, are we kicking butt and taking names now. High inflation, high unemployment. A president of the United States, Jimmy Carter, who's standing in front of us, the best is over for the United States. Now, the way it's going to work now is in the wintertime, turn your thermostats down. Turn your thermostats down in the winter. My dad always told me, in the wintertime, turn the thermostat up. Now, when it's hot and you're broiling in, turn your thermostats down. No, up. I mean, turn them up. No, you need air conditioning. Turn your thermostats down in the summer. I love 70. Blah, 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 blah. And Carter stands there giving a nationwide speech with a cardigan sweater. In front of a fireplace. It's over, friends. The best is over for the United States. And Ronald Reagan said, I think I see the fundamental problem. I know, Ron, 1 minute. I see the fundamental problem. We've had a 70% tax rate in this country for 50 years. 5 decades of a 70% tax rate. It's killed incentives. It's time to lower the tax rates from 70 to 50 to 28%. Bingo! We then have the 25 greatest years that the United States has ever seen. Next week, you thought it was recession. You're wrong. Next week, we'll have Kevin back. Next week, taxes, and then somewhere else, recession. I'll close in prayer. Father, if I have said things that have offended people, I ask their forgiveness. If we've said it wrong, it's man thinking instead of you. Thanks to what you did in Williams, Arizona this weekend. Thanks to what you're doing in Papua New Guinea with the great help of Kevin and Debbie Ludwig. Thanks for what you've done in this class. I pray you'll continue to bless them, and we look forward to a great next hour at the main service. Lord, with you, with every person in Jesus' precious name, amen. I'll just say this. Thanks. Next week, I didn't want to get in the way of Wayne's book signing, but next week, I wrote a book in 1995 called It's Tea Time Again. Can you believe it? 1995, right in the middle of the Clinton presidency. And I want to give each of you a copy, but I want you to throw something in the box as far as monetary, and then we'll give it to the class for your next big class party, maybe your Christmas party. So I do not want you to take a book for free. You throw in a dollar, throw in five, throw in 20, throw in, and it all goes to the class. But we'll do that next Sunday, not today. How's that? There it is. Okay. We want you to throw in 5, 10, 20, or more, and it all goes to the Ludwigs. What an idea. I mean, what an idea. So that's what we're going to do next time. It's tea time again. Bye-bye.